It's 19:30 UTC on Wednesday, November 29th, and this is Zimbabwe Today. Good evening. I'm Kudzimai Mutetwa.
And I'm Chidonzere on VOA Zimbabwe Today.
Zimbabwe's High Court has acquitted a prominent pastor who was arrested for criticizing former President Mugabe. Human rights groups say today's ruling is a clear message from the new government of President Emmerson Mnangagwa. Sebastian Mofu reports from VOA from Harare.
Announcing the not guilty verdict Wednesday, Justice Priscilla Chigumba said state lawyers had failed to prove that in July of last year, Pastor Ivan Mawarire had called for violent protests and attempted to unseat then-President Robert Mugabe. Instead, the High Court judge said the clergyman acted within his rights when he called for Zimbabweans to stay at home to push the government to address the moribund economy. Mawarire is the activist behind the hashtag This Flag movement launched in 2016 to protest the government's handling of the economy and human rights abuses. When Wednesday's verdict was announced, Mawarire punched the air before smiling. Afterward, he spoke to reporters.
To the citizens of Zimbabwe, none of us should ever be afraid to animate our own constitution. Whilst I'm elated and excited at the result, I am saddened that this is what we have to go through for freedoms and rights in our own nation. One does hope that as our country changes and begins to move forward, that things like this should never, ever be allowed to happen to the citizens of this nation.
The change he's referring to, of course, is the dramatic turn of events that resulted in President Mugabe resigning last week after 37 years in office. Mugabe's former deputy, Emmerson Mnangagwa, was sworn in as president Friday and will serve as head of state until elections are held next year. Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights says Wednesday's ruling puts the new government on notice. The organization is representing both Mawarire and an American woman charged this month with subversion over a tweet she allegedly posted criticizing Mugabe. Harrison Nkomo of the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights was at the courthouse Wednesday.
Naturally, this should work as a guideline. In law, we call it a precedent. It should work as a guideline to police officers, to politicians, especially in this new era, on the principles of human rights and the constitution.
Christopher Mutangadura, who represented the state in Mawarire's case, told VOA the government will not challenge the High Court's ruling. However, Mawarire's legal troubles are not over yet. He faces another charge of subversion following his arrest in September of this year after he called for more anti-government protests. The date has not been set for that trial. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
The acquittal of activist Evan Mawarire today in Harare has been seen as a hopeful sign for the new government of President Emmerson Mnangagwa. After years of repression under the former President Mugabe, there are expectations of greater freedom of expression. Tanonuka Wande from VOA's Zimbabwe service is here with us in Studio 22 to talk about whether those expectations will be met. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So what does the acquittal mean to Pastor Mawarire in particular and to the people in general?
To him personally, I think he should be very, very happy because he has proved that bad cannot triumph over good. And as a pastor, it is a lesson, a practical lesson, in the way that he handled the situation. He actually did it, and he showed the people. So I do believe that it is a very important outcome, both religiously for himself and for the generality of the people of Zimbabwe. As for the people themselves, it is also a lesson in belief in self, that if you persevere long enough, you will succeed in the end. So I think we are all winners in this case. And also, like the report earlier on indicated, the government is on notice Some of these laws are very outdated, and we wait to see how the government is going to react in similar cases that are still in the books.
What do you think of the way he drew attention to the Zimbabwe situation, and how do you think he succeeded?
It was a masterstroke. Simple methods are the most effective. You don't have to get violent or to go to great lengths. But if we consider how it all started, just a flag, a cell phone, WhatsApp, and Facebook, and a very amateur video, if I may say so, and the way it was set up, the simplicity, I think that is what attracted people to this. It just started slowly, and then it picked up momentum, meaning that the way it was packaged was so simple that people felt very comfortable with that. And so more and more people signed on, and it became a movement. So, you know, that was a very a masterstroke, if I might say.
What lessons can Zimbabweans learn from Pastor Mawarire's experience?
Our individual determination wins in the end. You don't give up. You just keep on hammering. You just keep on doing what you want to do so that you can achieve what you have set out to achieve. You stay with your convictions and fight for them. This is the lesson that we learn from this outcome.
Do you see him continuing his political activism post-Mugabe era?
For now, he might lie low. He has already started to show signs of great respect to the new government and to even the President Mnangagwa himself. So I think for now he might lie low. But I don't think that if we don't see good results from this government, from this leader, that he will stay quiet at all. It doesn't strike me as a person who might just ignore bad things just for his sake. So for now, he might lie low, but if things don't go well, we can expect to hear or see him in the scene again.
Well, thank you for coming and speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Zimbabwe's new president is using different words than Robert Mugabe used, and in some cases, Emmerson Mnangagwa's actions complement his language. Reporter Kudzai Zinalashe explores the case against critics who faced prosecution under Mugabe's rule.
Martha O'Donovan, a 25-year-old American, was arrested in Zimbabwe early this month, accused of insulting President Robert Mugabe and trying to subvert a constitutional government. Sam Farai Monroe is the creative director and co-founder of Magamba Network, where O'Donovan works.
Her remand hearing was supposed to be Friday, 24th November. We appeared in court and it was remanded again to the 8th of December. Now the case has been postponed again, so it seems to be dragging on and on.
Following O'Donovan's arrest, authorities raided the Magamba Network offices.
It happened about 1.5 weeks after Martha's arrest, literally the day the tanks were rolling into the streets and as the coup was actually taking place. Our offices were raided by CID from the Law and Order Division. They confiscated all Magamba laptops that they found on allegations of subverting constitutional government.
The organization's work in new media, the arts and in activism caught the attention of the Mugabe government.
The projects that are very much being targeted by the state are Magamba TV, through which we produce a lot of the top political satire shows, The Week and Zambezi News, and also our Be the Media project, through which we run the popular Twitter handle Open Pali, where young citizen journalists tweet live from parliament and from other political events.
The government under Mugabe cracked down on critics with strict laws restricting speech. A group of four men have an ongoing court case for booing former First Lady Grace Mugabe at a rally. Another journalist has a case for reporting that Mrs. Mugabe had donated used underwear. And today, a court acquitted political activist Ivan Mawarire of charges similar to those O'Donovan faces. Prosecutors under Mugabe pushed all these arrests, Political analyst Eldred Masunungure says he thinks such cases still must proceed through courts, but the outcomes may be milder than in past cases.
I think those probably will fall by the wayside, but of course, you know, rule of law dictates that those cases run their course, but I don't think the state, you know, will be insistent, you know, on getting them persecuted beyond what they have already suffered.
While these cases may eventually be thrown out, new cases are coming to the courts, including those of politicians accused of corruption, fraud, and abusing office while serving in Mugabe's administration. But others say that under new President Emmerson Mnangagwa, the rule of law could not be worse than under Mugabe. For VOA, this is Kutsa Nawashe from Harare.
British Foreign Minister Boris Johnson has commented on Zimbabwe at a summit of the African Union and European Union in Abidjan, Ivory Coast. He told diplomats there that the international community has got to see the democratic process unfold. He said that it's important that Zimbabweans have free and fair elections next year. He says that if that goal is met, the British government will help stabilize Zimbabwe's economy as well as help clear both World Bank and African Development Bank debt. Elections in Zimbabwe are to be held next year. President Mnangagwa stressed in his inauguration speech that polling would go ahead as scheduled. You're listening.
There's been a constant stream of Zimbabweans in neighboring South Africa since 2000, when former President Robert Mugabe's government began a sometimes violent crackdown on its opponents, sparking an economic and social meltdown. Groups aiding migrants in South Africa say there's little sign of a mass return to Zimbabwe following its recent political changes. But a public health expert says that most migrants who do eventually return will probably be extremely traumatized. Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
No one's sure exactly how many Zimbabweans are in South Africa striving for better lives. Aid groups say it's at least 2 million. Professor Joe Veery examines the effects of forced migration on people's health and emotional well-being for the African Center for Migration and Society at Wits University in Johannesburg. Veery says migrants are choosing to remain in South Africa despite their daily struggles for food and shelter.
The stress of trying to access particular services, combined with the stress of how sometimes non-nationals are treated. So, for example, a fear of violence, experiencing xenophobia or anti-foreign sentiment can affect the way that they can function day to day. It can affect their ability to deal with underlying trauma or previous problems because getting by in the day to day is so difficult.
Furia acknowledges that many South Africans also battle to get adequate mental health care, for example. But she says for the Zimbabweans, problems like these are compounded by their marginalization in South African society.
What we then see is that where individuals may wish to try and access public health care services, they may actually choose not to try because of fear of the way that they may be treated, fear of the police, and those sorts of issues.
She particularly remembers stories of pregnant Zimbabwean women who've tried to access maternal health care.
They feel that they are very much sidelined in terms of treatment, often feeling that they are made to wait far longer and not given support and help from healthcare professionals.
Fury says Zimbabweans often bear the brunt of xenophobia because of their sheer numbers in South Africa. But she adds that some migrants have also been treated generously.
Particularly in state structures, there are some fantastic people working, whether it's in frontline healthcare or in other services, who really do go out of their way to support and ensure that Zimbabweans are able to access the services to which they're entitled, supporting children getting into school.
She says many Zimbabweans will stay in South Africa because no matter how bad it is here, at this stage, it's still better than back home.
but also about being able to live in a context where people don't feel threatened by virtue of, for example, political affiliation, ensuring that people can feel safe and secure in the place in which they're living.
She hopes that the change in Zimbabwe will result in a government that cares more about all its people's rights and gives them avenues to what she calls the social determinants of health and emotional well-being.
And what we really need to do is think about how we can support, both in Zimbabwe and in South Africa, access to those very basic fundamental rights. And what we should then see is the ways in which that would then impact on improving people's health and well-being.
But Fieri says most Zimbabweans she's speaking with say they won't go back to the country of their birth unless its economy improves dramatically, especially since the cash that some earn in South Africa keeps their families back home alive. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
After the longtime ruler of Zimbabwe stepped down, Zimbabwe made Robert Mugabe's birthday a public holiday. February 21st will henceforth be known as the Robert Gabriel Mugabe National Youth Day. Calls for the former president's birthday to be made a national holiday started months ago, but in the wake of his resignation, the reaction is mixed on social media. Some are positive about the idea.
Simon Chingono says, Mugabe Day, long overdue.
King KGC says, perhaps it's time we honor a hero before his death.
But many others are angry.
SJ1 says, and people wonder why Zimbabwe is a total and utter basket case, heaping praise on the dictator who killed tens of thousands and turned a once prosperous country into a totally poverty-stricken mess.
Brighton says, yeah, those bootlickers are on steroids. Thought they would put a public holiday to remember hundreds of Ndebeles who were butchered by Mugabe's regime.
Zimbabwe has not had its own currency for nearly 4 years. Most day-to-day business is done with the U.S. dollar, rand, and euro. However, many Zimbabweans are trading in Bitcoin, the cryptocurrency. In recent weeks, the value of Bitcoin has surged, in part led by demand in Zimbabwe. VOA financial reporter Jill Malandrino joins us to explain the Bitcoin surge. Bitcoin continues to make headlines as it breaks records at an aggressive pace. With more on the latest news is Jill Malandrino, business correspondent in New York City. Before we start, remind the audience how the technology behind Bitcoin actually works.
Well, behind most cryptocurrencies is a technology known as blockchain, and that's a system residing in multiple computers that allows for peer-to-peer financial ledger recording of all transactions occurring in a network and is being widely adopted across all industries. This results in a transparent, open access registry of monetary flows, which makes the intermediation of banking authorities unnecessary. Thus, it challenges the conventional belief that money can only work through central planning. Conventional money is managed by states and banks with users on the receiving end of monetary policy decisions. By contrast, most alternative currencies are peer-to-peer. That means they're being managed by users themselves and do not require intermediaries.
How does Bitcoin trade?
Bitcoin currently trades on virtually unregulated markets. Anyone on the sidelines has essentially missed out on this massive rally. Bitcoin's price surpassed $11,000 for the first time earlier Wednesday and has increased in value by more than 11 times in 2017. So this milestone marks a crazy ascent from just 6 cents 7 years ago and less than $1,000 at the start of 2017. The surge comes as cryptocurrencies are beginning to gain the attention of institutional investors. The Chicago Mercantile Exchange, or what we call the CME, plans to list futures in the cryptocurrency as soon as December. JP Morgan is considering allowing its clients to trade Bitcoin futures. Some investors are buying and launching their own crypto funds. So this skyrocketing value has also been a blessing for alternative cryptocurrencies like Ethereum, for example. The market cap of 1,324 digital coins is tracked by CoinMarketCap has grown from $17.5 billion to over $325 billion. And I think the allure of cryptocurrency is it's decentralized and deregulated. So I'm curious to see how the marketplace will receive it once it becomes more regulated with the exchange getting involved in new products being introduced. So will it be the derivatives of cryptocurrency being regulated or the underlying cryptocurrency itself.
So why would people trade in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies?
Well, we discussed this before on the show with Zimbabwe in particular, and it's been popular in that country for quite a while now. After the country's hyperinflation crisis of 2008, 2009, huge amounts of personal savings were lost, and Zimbabwean citizens were understandably eager to find new ways to secure their own savings and assets. If you recall, they had a $100 trillion Zimbabwean note come out, and that's just unheard of in modern monetary policy. It's also being widely adopted across the globe as a way to transact money in day-to-day purchases. I've met with companies that use Bitcoin as part of rewards programs now. I think it's slower to adopt in developed economies because of how advanced the banking systems are. While developing economies have really embraced it, which I think is the most interesting thing to see, it seems to be more of a trading vehicle in the developed world. And in fact, this piece of data came out earlier. Charles Schwab, it's one of the largest online brokers in the U.S. They reported 10.6 million active brokerage accounts for October, in contrast with 11.7 million users in October for Coinbase, which is the leading U.S. platform for buying and selling Bitcoin. That number, just since this report, has grown to 13.3 million as of Sunday. And that's according to Alistair Millen of the Altana Digital Currency Fund. So this just shows the impressive growth in what can be argued, I would say Bitcoin and cryptocurrency in general, is its own asset class.
Thank you so much for joining us. That is Jill Malandrino from New York City.
Zimbabwe's Supreme Court today ruled that Sexual Rights Center can hold demonstrations. 2 years ago, police banned the group known as SRC from holding a protest in Bulawayo. Members wanted to promote respect for the rights of sex workers on the day of the International Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers. The High Court supported the ban, which sent the SRC to the highest court. Mahofu Ndlovu, the SRC lead organizer, says he is very happy with today's ruling. His group says that sex workers and members of the LGBTI community frequently experience violence or abuse, so it is important to raise awareness among the public. Lovu told VOA's Taura Ishawa, the Supreme Court ruling means the group can observe the day to protect sex workers on December 17th. Lawyers Network Human Rights Commissioner Tanaya Mukiwa also welcomed ruling. He tells VOA the group hopes the decision will push the new government of Emmerson Mnangagwa to respect the rights of sex workers and sexual minorities.
The significant progress made in recent decades against malaria is at risk, according to the World Health Organization. Henry Ridgewell reports that in its annual report looking at the global fight against the disease, the WHO says malaria cases are on the rise in several countries.
Many countries are moving toward eliminating malaria, among them Madagascar, Senegal, and Zimbabwe. But a WHO report warns that in others, progress has stalled. Malaria cases increased by more than 20% from 2015 to 2016 in 8 African countries, including Rwanda, Nigeria, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. At the same time, funding for malaria prevention and treatment has leveled off, reaching $2.7 billion in 2016, less than half of the 2020 target. Professor David Conway is from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine.
That amount of funding internationally has plateaued. Possibly it's reached the realistic maximum. And it's always been assumed, indeed it's been important, that countries themselves should commit to funding malaria control. And I think the big opportunity now is for those countries to step up and realise that this is good value.
Overall, Africa continues to bear the highest burden of the disease, with approximately 401,000 deaths in 2016, a slight decrease from the previous year. In addition to improving the coverage of existing methods of malaria prevention, the WHO calls for urgent investment in new tools. Again, Professor Conway.
It's been recognised for a long time that a malaria vaccine would transform the situation potentially. And so more research is needed to develop an effective malaria vaccine that could cover the populations that at the moment have high malaria rates and that perhaps don't use the available interventions even when they are being funded.
Several malaria vaccines are under development. The WHO is planning a major trial of the so-called RTSS vaccine starting next year in Kenya, Ghana and Malawi. But its latest report warns the world is at a crossroads. Without better funding and more effective rollout of tools to tackle malaria, the progress made in recent decades could be undone. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And finally today, Zimbabwe's youth has struggled over the past few decades with high unemployment, and many have felt the pressure of strict laws regarding media and arts. Reporter Kudzai Zinabashe speaks to young people about their hopes following the country's dramatic political change.
Zimbabwe has been on a political roller coaster in the past weeks, one that saw the resignation of Robert Mugabe as president after an unprecedented military intervention. Boniface Charumbira is a young Zimbabwean.
Well, I feel that what happened was necessary. I'm hoping that in the future or the days to come that things change, get better and improve. A lot of people had fear when it came to graduating and not knowing if they would have a job after they graduate.
Plot Marco is the founder of Jubiliga, a youth-run non-government organization. It works with young Zimbabweans to use art and popular culture for expression and engagement.
We feel that the political change in the country has opened a window for hope. It has rekindled the kind of enthusiasm that was starting to die down amongst the young people in Zimbabwe.
Yet others have reservations, in part because Mugabe's ZANU-PF party remains in control, and the new president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, was Mugabe's long-time deputy. Elvis Mugari is the founder and president of the Combined Restitution for Zimbabwean Youth, a non-profit organization that pushes for youth participation in decision-making positions in society.
Given the new political status quo, there is hope for the young people, but according to me, it's not Uhuru yet. What we are fighting for is not individuals, but the system. We still have the system in place, which is ZANU-PF.
Marco says he has hopes for Mnangagwa's administration.
My hope is that the dispensation would let young people freely do what they want, will be able to dream in a country where their rights are respected, thoughts and aspirations are supported, are promoted, and allowed to thrive. Where they can even occupy spaces of political influence, of economic balance, being able to also access jobs and livelihood.
Marco is optimistic and says the political developments over the past weeks are a step in the right direction. Mugari says electoral reforms and media freedom are priorities Mnangagwa will need to address if he is truly going a different direction from his predecessor. But Mugari has doubts those reforms will come anytime soon. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinabashe from Harare.
Taura mushako, burumu unesimba, shwamuno taura mushako, reka kutamba nemashoko, reka kutamba nemashoko.
That's it for us this evening on VOA's Zimbabwe Today. I'm Kudzanai Mutetwa.
And I'm Chidonjere. We'll be back again tomorrow at 9:30 p.m. Zimbabwe time for the latest news and analysis in English. VOA Shona and Debele broadcast can be heard at 6 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. Zimbabwe time.
Stay with us around the clock on Facebook at Studio 7, VOA Ndebele, and VOA Shona, as well as our VOA website, www.studio7news.com.